Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in this world. We're going to explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, mental, relationships, disabilities, physical, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team so far consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors, as well as a number of authors. My name is Tom Tutall Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter, and I spoke in March of this year at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was the keynote speaker for the event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since age 5. That's 44 years now. And I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced. Makes me sound like a spider. And I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". Sometimes I lie and say 5'2". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. Despite those physical challenges, everyone who knows me knows I am well known for always answering amazing when asked how I'm doing. I tell people 80% of the time it's true. The other 20% of the time it's to remind myself that it's true. I'm also a senior editorial researcher for the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website, Tom, the number 2, and Tall, TALL.com. And I'm really excited to have as my guest today, Scott Duffy. Scott is a high-energy author, speaker, and strategist. He began his career working for best-selling author and speaker Tony Robbins and went on to help launch small businesses that became big brands like CBS Sportsline, wow, very cool, NBC Internet, and FoxSports.com. Next, he founded Smart Charter, an online booking tool for private aviation, which was acquired by the world-famous Richard Branson's Virgin Group. Scott is a passionate advocate for entrepreneurship, and he's been a frequent guest in numerous media outlets, including CNBC, Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and Business Week. Scott currently lives in Southern California with his wife and 2 children and is just back from my friend Greg Reed's Secret Knock event for the past 3 days. Welcome to the show today, Scott.
Oh, man, it's great to be here, Tom. And I got to tell you, I always laugh when I hear that introduction. And I have to tell you why. It's because it just sounds so easy. And I'm like, I want to meet that guy. But the reality is, you know, the path to being successful in anything in life is typically littered in failure. And, you know, what I found, and one of the things I love about the Napoleon Hill Foundation and the things that you're doing is that it's been during those times in my life where, you know, things have been tough or I've had business challenges where someone has reached out and given a hand to help pull me out. Or a book like Think and Grow Rich has inspired me to really kind of continue on and keep charging forward. I'm just happy and I feel blessed to be here with you today.
It's exciting for me as well. And I always try to start my show with, when it applies, the question, when did you first read the amazing book, one of the top 20 best-selling and most purchased books of all time, Think and Grow Rich? How old were you? Was there someone special in your life that said, Scott, you should read this book?
Well, when I was, I think I was 19, my junior year in college, I was on my way down to Mexico. I went to school in San Diego, and one of the traditions at the time was after midterm exams, people from my school and the other big schools in the area used to caravan down to an area called San Felipe, Mexico, and have kind of like a 3 or 4 day party after exams, and it was a heck of a lot of fun at the time. until my junior year. And my junior year, everything changed for me. It changed in a heartbeat. And what happened was I was on my way down to Mexico for one of these trips. I was one of the first cars down. And I was in a part of Mexico that was, if you've ever been down to Baja, think of it this way. You've got one road with one lane in each direction, and then desert as far as you can see. And we were way out in the desert, way south of the border, and a garbage truck who had gone off the side tried to gun up and basically drove right out on the road in front of us. We hit this car going about 75 miles an hour, never even saw him. And when we got in this accident, crazy, it was a horrible accident, a terrible thing that happened. All of us were knocked out. The guys that we hit actually took everything out of our car, stolen, and took off and left us there. And, we all had terrible injuries. I actually was sitting there on the road or lying there on the road in the middle of the desert, two brain hemorrhages, head through the windshield, my arm through the door, and really no hope for any of us until someone who just happened to be going to the same campsite that we were in an RV stopped and took us out of the car and helped get us to the border and helped get us to San Diego where we got treated hours later. And it was during my recovery, I really couldn't do a whole heck of a lot. I was down for a long time. I couldn't watch television because of my head injuries. I couldn't read. I couldn't listen to music. But I started to do something that I had never done before, just to get through the day. And that was listen to books on tape. Especially my focus was motivational books on tape. And there were some people, my friends, they all went to class, and I just laid there in my classroom was listening to Tony Robbins and Jim Rohn and listening to Napoleon Hill and Brian Tracy. And, it's really interesting because, that accident, what happened my junior year in college, felt at the time like the worst thing that could have happened to me. It was the worst day of my life. But what happened, how it got me into listening to these motivational books and motivational speakers really changed my life. If I got better and I started to get stronger, I made a commitment to myself, and the commitment was I wanted to work as an intern for one of these people that inspired me. And Tony and Jim Rohn and Brian Tracy were all in San Diego, so I went and applied as an intern, and Tony Robbins and his company, Robbins Research, offered me this great job. And I never returned to college. And so in my late teens and my early 20s, I spent my time around that industry, around people that had overcome amazing obstacles in their lives and turned these things into positive things. And it was really during that period where I became fully immersed in Napoleon Hill and became, one of the biggest fans of the book on this planet.
And wow, what a story. Like, as you said, that could be the worst day of your life. But in the end, when you look after that and what it caused you to get into, probably the most positive event that's happened in your life in a funny and weird way.
Well, it is. I remember I was at a lunch. We were promoting an event for Tony Robbins, and I was a young guy, and I remember telling him the story. And he said to me something that stuck with me forever. It's really become an operating principle in my life as an entrepreneur. And it was this. He said, "You have good days and you have bad days, but you don't know which is which until sometime way down the line, because you don't know what you'll make of the experience." And I think this was a perfect example.
Totally. And, similar, whenever I've had these very numerous joint replacement surgeries, and often beforehand I'm in somewhat of excruciating pain, this is when I really pour into these books and have since I'm in my early 20s. And, boy, first of all, there's all kinds of stories in those books, Tony Robbins, Jim Rohn, Brian Tracy, all of the things they have talk about people who really went through things that you know, made mine look pretty silly. And so you're like, okay, look at what that guy did with that. I can do amazing with this circumstance. And so it's funny how at the worst times of our life, that's when we reach out for positive motivation, and it often ends up helping us get through the event way better, and often even can change our lives. And so amazing. Now, the Tony Robbins thing, wow. Working for Tony Robbins, I bet a lot of people offer to work there for free. I bet they get like many applications a day. Did you do anything special, plead, beg, stand outside at 5 a.m.? How did you manage to do that? Because, boy, I'll intern for Tony Robbins for sure.
Yeah, it's so funny that you asked that question, because the answer is yes, I did. I wanted to stand out, and I was a young guy, and I didn't have, you know, I had very little work experience, and so I thought I had to do something creative to get his attention. And what I did is, you know, I knew he was a tall guy, and so I went and I bought this big tall cardboard box. And I filled it about halfway with this packing material. And then in the center of the box, on top of the packing material, I put my resume. And then Tony talks a lot about association. So I put things that I thought Tony associated to positively. Like I cut out a picture of his wife from one of his company's magazines, one of his tapes from one of his tape programs. I had a copy of his book and all these things around my resume. And then I put more packing material on top. And at the top of the box, when I sealed it, I had this little fancy thing I put on top, and it said, "How can Robbins Research benefit with Scott Duffy as a member of its team?" And the idea was I was hoping that this tall box would pique the interest and he'd kind of get down there and have to get in there and tear it out and you know, that hopefully give me a call. And so what I did is I paid, because I didn't have money to pay a messenger, and I kind of was nervous about dropping it off myself. I actually paid one of my friends, one of my fraternity brothers, to drive it up to the office. And he said, if he doesn't sign for it, I said, will you just bring it back and we'll try it again tomorrow? And that's what we did. They signed off for it, and it was actually someone who worked for Tony, Michael Hutchison, who ended up taking it in and gave me, really, I think, the opportunity of a lifetime, particularly at that time in my life, to go and promote Tony's programs and sell Tony's his programs at the time.
Wow. Did he sign for it himself?
You know, I don't know. My guess is that he probably didn't.
That would be quite a sales job.
Right, but the thing is, it doesn't matter, right? I think if we're creative, you know, if we're willing to kind of just step outside of the box and do something different. I'll tell you, I'm in my office right now, and I have on my desk a couple of things that people have done that have always stood out to me when they were trying to find a job for companies I worked with or the companies that I started. So, for example, I have a big it's a whiteboard that's on my wall. And, you know, it was probably 10 years ago. We were relaunching FoxSports.com. And there was a girl who had just graduated from college, and she really wanted to break into the sports industry. And so what she did is she sent me a resume, and the resume was different than anything I had ever seen. What it was is it was pictures of her in all of the sports moments of her life. And so the first one was watching, like, her first football game with her dad, her first little cheerleading outfit, and all these different sports things up until the point where she graduated. It was really cool. But what really got me is she had this whiteboard, and on the whiteboard it was X's and O's. I'm looking at it right now. X's and O's of why I should hire her. And she called it, at the top it says, "This is my chalk doc," which is an expression that's used frequently by coaches when writing on the board what play to run. And so, you know, there's so – it sounds corny. I know it does. It sounds corny. But these things stand out. And 10 years later, I use this as an example for everybody that walks in this door. So don't be afraid to do something that sounds a little corny or a little bit cheesy or whatever, because people will remember you. And today, in such a competitive world, sometimes it's those little things that make the biggest difference.
Oh, totally, totally. And creativity. I'm coaching, mentoring a few younger people now looking for a job, and this is my advice, is get creative, stand out somehow, pick out a company you want to work for and do something that will catch their attention. And then you also said you didn't have a lot of money. You don't need to send a Rolls Royce to the front door. You can do it almost for free. You may have to enlist a friend like you did, but there, it doesn't have to cost you money, but do something where people are going to be sitting around in the office that day talking about what you did. Did you see that package? There was a whole big box, and, you know, and there was only like a few pieces of paper and a book and that in it, and, you know, imagine the discussion. You got buzz going before you even get to the interview because of your uniqueness. And you know, if you do something like that, the employer's got to think, well, I got to at least meet this person.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think that one of the keys to this idea is just be fun, right? Be real. People like to have fun. And you know, I know when folks are out there, if they're looking for a job, or let's say they're trying to raise capital somewhere and get in the door, you know, sometimes things, you know, can feel intense, right? And we may be under pressure because we really, you know, or maybe there's a time crunch. We feel we need to be successful now, and we get really serious, and all that stuff starts to make the activity feel tight, right? But the reason that this chalkboard is here is because it was just so fun, right? It's not even, I mean, it's messy. It's all that kind of stuff. I'm looking at something else here on my desk. When I was at CBS Sportsline, there was somebody that wanted to break into sales, and he didn't have any experience selling advertising at the time, and that's what we're selling, online advertising. And there was another candidate that he was competing against. They had a lot of experience selling advertising. So in order to stand out, one of the things he did is he called me and he said, we had said no, is he called me and he said, is there anything else that I could do? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, let me give you one more resume. He said, whatever you do, don't make a final decision until the end of the day. So I'll never forget, later that day, I heard some people out in the lobby yell, hey, Scott, you got to come out here. So I walk out of my office, and this guy throws a football all the way across the office. Now, this particular candidate played basketball for USC, and what he threw to me was a football that was signed by the athletic director of USC that says, Scott, fight on USC, Mike Garrett. P.S., Rich is the guy. Don't mess up. He's the best. Higher ground.
Wow.
Right? It was so fun, and it was so funny. You know, it's and this probably didn't cost anything.
Yeah.
Except for the gas it took to get to the office. So, you know, just not to belabor the point, but, you know, sometimes you got to do something a little bit different to stand out. And when you're trying to stand out, what you put together, just try to make it fun.
Yeah, yeah. And it kind of reminds me, the very first goal I ever wrote down was to meet the then Prime Minister of Canada, Brian Mulroney. And people were telling me, not going to happen. So I knew his life, studied his autobiography. I wrote a letter detailing some of the goals he accomplished. One of them was he used to go to university and tell people, oh, yeah, I spoke with John Diefenbaker, who was the president prime minister when he was young, and all his classmates would say, yeah, sure, right, right. So he told Diefenbaker this, and Diefenbaker came to his class one day. So all the people, friends that said, you're full of BS, suddenly had to take back their word. So I wrote this in a letter. I said, for 15 minutes of your time, you can help me accomplish the very first written goal I have. And a couple of months later, I'm sitting in my office. I get a call from the Prime Minister's office. We would like to set up a meeting with the Prime Minister. And I said, well, would that be at his office or my office? And so, of course, they laughed and said, yeah, I think that should be at our office here. And I remember going through a metal detector to get in there. There was RCMP on both sides. They both had large guns and very large bodies. And you can imagine with all the metal in my body, that metal detector practically shot out of the air. And their first reaction is to put their hand on their gun. So that was a little bit nervous, nerve-wracking. But just a creative letter. Didn't send it by Purolator or anything special. Maybe registered mail, but it cost me next to nothing to send it and nothing to write the letter. And so unique, creative, and a bunch of people told me it couldn't be done. And I had my picture taken with them to show them it can be done. So
that's awesome.
I think
a lesson there too is that my mentor, my business partner Greg Reed, he's written over 45 books that he's had published, over 20 bestsellers, and one of the things that Greg does is he interviews people that are the most successful people in different areas of our life and our culture, and he just has a knack for being able to get to everybody. And I've asked Greg over and over again, how is it that you get to this person? How is it that you're able to get that deal done? How can you get this? And he taught me a lesson. The lesson is this. The people that are most successful are usually the most accessible. So, again, the people that are most successful are usually the people that are the most accessible. And the reason is the people that are the most successful usually have made it at some level. They have people that work for them that are doing stuff, or maybe they're taking time off and not working. So they have time. The people below that are doing everything they can and spending all their time to get to that place. So don't be afraid of reaching out to someone who is at the top of anything. The odds are that's the person that you're most likely to get. And they're probably waiting for your call.
Exactly. And they love to help. So if you can combine the request with an opportunity for them to help, maybe not just you, but a group of people or an organization or some way that is going to make a difference to people, these people will, have seven people call you to contact you to see how they can get together with you. And so this is, as you said, don't assume that just because it's a big name, you can't reach them. Set it as a goal. Think creatively. Think of a way that they can help you, but also help other people by doing it. And the odds are you're going to have a phone call saying, when can we get together? And you're going to be stuttering and stammering for a little bit, but you'll end up meeting these people. Now, Scott, when I was reading like CBS Sportsline and FoxSports.com, these are like well-known, everybody knows FoxSports.com. You're behind some of these things? This is incredible, and obviously they have somewhat of a sports theme behind them. Maybe not the NBC Internet, but wow, those are some pretty big brands. And it started, you helped get them to where today everybody knows them.
Well, I think, first of all, I've been incredibly fortunate to have been able to work for some just incredible entrepreneurs. And anything that I've done, from the first company that I worked for, anything that I've done successfully, I really stand on their shoulders, and I attribute so much to them. And it started up in the Bay Area working with a company called Quote.com, and Quote.com was one of the first businesses in the U.S. to get permission from the exchanges to put stock quotes on the consumer internet, and really helped to create that market and define it and be the leading brand. And Chris, who was the founder of that company, was absolutely exceptional. I was fortunate to have been there, right near the beginning, and to help, walk through the process, that company kind of growing up. Sportsline was a similar type of situation. I was very fortunate to have joined that company early. And Sportsline USA did a deal with CBS to become CBS Sportsline, and that was really the first, major broadcasters, to do a deal with an internet business. And it was a really exciting time. It was a chance to to be involved in some of the first cross-media sales opportunities and promotions where, you know, folks on television would be promoting a website and driving traffic to the website. And, you know, that was really exciting. NBC Internet, just a great story, a phenomenal entrepreneur named Chris Kitsy, somebody that I can't tell you how much I look up to Chris. You know, Chris taught me a lesson that I just love to share. When I worked for Chris, Chris had this a slogan, "Go sell something." And in a time, you know, this was 1997, I think, 97, 98, 99, 2000, right around that time, when the internet was really taking off, we were in the middle of kind of the dot-com boom. While other companies were out there, you know, with expensive offices and expensive furniture and spending everything that we had, Chris had a completely different culture that he created. And his culture was, you know, we moved into an office with ripped carpets and the paint was coming off the walls because those things weren't important. What was important was to build a good product and to generate revenue and create shareholder value. And Chris signed every single email to everybody in the company, "Go sell something." And what it did is it really created the sales-driven culture. And so when we would go through experiences where there were challenges in the business or we had bumps in the road like every company does, you know, we had the right mentality to sell our way out of those problems. And I thank him for that, and I just respect him so much for that.
Yeah, it's so valuable to have that. If you can learn to sell, you should never be unemployed.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, every single person in a business should think of themselves as a salesperson. You know, their job is to create a product that serves a customer's need and to service that customer and to sell that product. So whether you are in the sales department or you're in this case, the technology department, you know, to think like a customer. That's what's really so important. And again, that's the culture that Chris instilled it at a company called Zoom.com, which later became NBC Internet.
Wow, and kind of in a funny way, when you have an office with torn carpets and paint peeling off the wall, people don't want to sit there. They want to be out on the road selling. They don't have the nice comfy chairs and the big coffee makers and the large wooden desks. They're like, geez, I don't want to spend any time in the office. I got to get out and see people and get into nicer offices.
Well, you know, I'll tell you another interesting story about Zoom that I'm so proud of and I think just bled out of our culture was when we went public, I believe it was December of 98, it was a time where most people don't remember that in the summer of 1998, the stock market, we've been going through this dot-com kind of explosion, right? And there were a bunch of companies going public up in the Bay Area, and valuations were going through the roof. But in the later part of the summer, things really quieted down. In fact, the market really turned the other way. And so what happened was a bank stopped taking companies public, right? It was like everything was put on hold for about 6 months. And in December of that year, we had kind of the first internet company go back out with a public offering, and the stock shot from wherever it went out to well over $100 in just a day. It was crazy. Whew. And then a couple of days later, the second one went out, and the same thing happened. The stock shot from, let's say, wherever it started, 12, 20, wherever it was, to well over $100. And then we were the next guys out. And I remember that all of us were thinking, oh, gosh, this is going to be great. You know, we can't wait, and we're counting how much money we're going to make and all that, getting ahead of ourselves. And what was interesting was the other two or three companies, whatever the number was, that had shot up like that, immediately saw their share price start to decrease. People saw that quick hit, and they take out money. And a lot of investors got burned. And what Chris really wanted to do and what the team wanted to do was to build a company that created real shareholder value. And so instead of going out at a price like that, the company went out for a much lower price. But what we did is we built value and watched that price go up steadily for the next couple of years. And it was just it was a whole different mindset than other people had at the time, but it was the right mindset. And I think that we always need to stay focused on delivering the right product at the right time to our customers, delivering all kinds of value, and thinking as business owners about the long term and how we're going to deliver this over the long term versus just that quick hit.
Exactly, exactly. Now, tell me a little bit about Smart Charter. That's an online booking tool for private aviation. Were you driving down the road or sleeping in bed or watching TV and this brainwave came upon you and you're like, holy smokes? Or had you decided on, okay, I'm going to start a new thing? Like, how did you come up with that? Because that is a... when you think of it now, it's like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. But at the time, it probably didn't make sense to some other people, maybe some of your friends. And to have Richard Branson, come on, Virgin Group, acquire it. How did you think of that, and how did you implement it and do so well with that?
Well, you know, I think What stands out the most to me about the experience, number one, is the opportunity to be able to learn from Richard and to watch Richard and how he operates and that was an amazing experience. But for me as an entrepreneur, it was just really exciting. You know, when I worked for Tony Robbins 20 plus years ago, the reason I decided to leave the training business was I wanted to get out there, and I felt this like urge to go build something. Like I wanted to go and start a business or go work for somebody that was starting a business and really help to grow something. And it was during that time that I started to share with some of the people on the road, you know, what I was thinking about, that one of the guys that worked for with me on the road for Tony gave me a book. And the book, you know, I think I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation how during times in my life where I've struggled or kind of like I've had lots of questions about where I was going, it's like someone at the right time always seems to lend a hand, right? There's something that happens. Somebody gave me the book, Losing My Virginity, from Richard Branson, and said, you should read this. Like, if you got that entrepreneurial bug, you got to read this book. And I'm like, hey, you know, Losing My Virginity, that's a pretty cool title, right? I'm gonna, that's like a good book. I'm going to read this. But the truth of the matter is I was really inspired. And I'm not even sure what I was inspired to do other than go work and build. And that's what kind of led me into technology. And you know, again, I was very fortunate to work for some really awesome people and be in at some really cool times. Now, with Virgin, what we did with Smart Charter is I had spoken with a friend, and he just brought up private aviation. We literally were having lunch, and he said, I just bumped into somebody, and they're in the private aviation business, and they were talking to me about how that business is growing and how kind of dysfunctional it is despite its growth. And he said, I think you should take a look at this business because I think there might be an opportunity in here somewhere. He said, I don't know where it is, but I think it's somewhere. I said, well, why don't we start by you introducing me to your friend because he sounds like an expert, and I'll go meet him. And so the next day, I actually flew to meet this guy, and he shared with me everything that he knew about private aviation. But here's what stood out: in commercial aviation, there's just a handful of operators like Virgin and American and United and Southwest, and they control virtually all of the passenger seats. And these airlines typically have hundreds of planes per airline. In private aviation, there were over 2,500 operators, and the typical operator only had 3 aircraft that they managed. And so what was interesting is no one had ever aggregated all the supply and demand in one place and made it easy to buy and sell a trip online. And so that was our vision. And we built a great team. I brought in Ron Garrett, who was the original chief architect and lead software developer on Google AdWords. Steve Chen, who is fantastic, you know, the head of artificial intelligence and I believe scheduling and planning stuff for JPL. And we started to build. And it was during that process that I was introduced to Virgin. And And eventually the company decided that they liked the idea. They bought the majority of the business in April 2007. I was fortunate enough to get the chance to run it for a couple of years, and it was an awesome time.
Wow. It sounded like one of the key ideas strategies or tips there is that, hey, a lot of people have great ideas, or a friend says, you know, this would be a great idea, and then that's the end of the great idea. But it sounds like when you hear a great idea, you immediately put your thinking cap on and your subconscious gets working and you get in front of people who are really know a lot about a specific industry and you implement it. You take massive action, as Tony Robbins talks about, and you don't just leave the idea on the table. You examine it, you interview people who know a lot about it, you get some genius people who can help you implement it. And so going from the idea to the implementation is where a lot of people have a challenge.
Well, you know, it's like at the beginning of our conversation when I said, you know, sometimes I laugh because when I hear all those big brands and all that stuff, it sounds so easy. So let me tell you the story behind the story of how things came together with Virgin, because I think it's a great lesson. And it really goes back to what you were just talking about as people. So I met my wife in Cancun at Club Med of all places. Who knew, right? And I was living in Los Angeles. My wife was she was living in New York, and I would fly out to New York to go and visit her. And on one of my first visits to see her in New York, we had breakfast with a group of people one morning, and the person sitting next to me had been on Richard's reality TV show, and he didn't win. But Richard and the team really liked him, and they offered him a job, and he had been there for quite a while. And one of the things that he did is he looked for new businesses and new industries for Virgin to invest and to get involved in. And we just talked, and we got to know each other, and over time, we started to develop a relationship. Now, I wasn't thinking about private aviation at the time. We weren't talking about doing anything together. You know, we were just getting to know each other. Now, fast forward a year and a half, we haven't spoken. And he calls me on a Saturday night, and he's at a party. And he's talking to somebody about private aviation. He says to this person that we at Virgin, we're thinking about getting into private aviation. And I had just started my project. And he spoke to somebody who knew me and said, before you talk to anybody, you got to talk to this guy, Scott, in Southern California. And so he called me that night, and he said, will you give me a call? I don't know if you remember me. Will you give me a call? So I did. So that Monday, we spoke, and I said to him, I said, hey, I got your message. What's going on? And he said, hey, we're thinking about getting into private aviation. Our team has a plan. Would you be interested, or would you be willing to share what you know about the industry? Would you do me that favor? And I said, absolutely. And I said, it would probably be best to do it in person. And he said, great. And he said, we're in New York, you're in L.A., when are you going to be here? Now, at that time, my wife had moved to L.A., so that's where we were. And I said, well, it just so happens I'm going to be there tomorrow. Now, I didn't have any trip planned for the next day. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm like, I want you to remember this, because this is so important. People ask all the time, is it more important to be lucky, or is it important to be smart when you're building a successful business? And my belief is this: you need to be smart enough to know when you're getting lucky, and then you need to hit that thing with everything that you have. And so what I did is I said, yeah, I'm going to be there the next morning. I took a red-eye flight. I showed up in the morning. I went to the office. And we met. And I met with the team, and they shared their plan. And they said, what do you think? And I said, well, are you really interested? Or you know, do you really want to know? Do you want to know what I really think? And they said, we want to know. And so I shared my opinion and you know, why I didn't think it was necessarily the right strategy at that time. And we said goodbye. And I walked out, and I was in the elevator. And the person who was the head of kind of development at the time came out, and he said, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, well, this is what I'm working on. And he said, you should be pitching us on that idea. And that's where it all started. And so, You know, and it's funny because everybody around me, everybody told me not to go to New York and told me not to take the meeting. They all said that Virgin has got tremendous resources, and if they want to do it, they'll do it themselves and they'll steal your idea. Right? But here's the thing. At that time, I mean, what did I have? I had a small team, an idea. I had a small team. We were starting to build, right? And so the question was, what did I really have to lose? And I think as entrepreneurs, as parents, as people that are just involved and active and want to give, so there's times where we have to make a decision. Right, and in this particular time, my decision was, again, what do I have to lose? I'm going to give it everything I got, and let's see what happens. And eventually, it led to a deal that ended up being, you know, from my, and it's just me, you know, from my perspective, I had the chance to work, you know, for a guy that for me was kind of the, you know, he's my entrepreneurial hero. So that was pretty cool.
And some great concepts in there, because also I think you should look at every opportunity. Don't throw your money in right away. Don't quit your job, but recognize an opportunity, or at least examine an opportunity. And I had the same kind of thing recently where a really, really amazing business person. I describe him as the most talented I've ever met in my life. He's coming out with a book and a bunch of workshops, starting this, getting into the speaking business. And he just had emailed me on a Thursday saying, I have some ideas and, you know, I'd like to talk to you and, you know, put these ideas on the table and, you know, whenever you would be able to come, or when could you come? And this is like a 5-hour drive from Toronto where I live. And so I told him, next weekend I'm coming to Ottawa. I have plans. I have plans to go there. And so I went there, and it was amazing that I went in person rather than doing this on the phone or by email, because he started out with a little coaching session with a couple of things I had done that annoyed him to the point where he thought, well, boy, until now Tom was on the top of my list to help me get this business going, but he did a few things that just not my style. And so, you know, maybe on the phone he wouldn't have done that. Maybe by email he wouldn't for sure have done that, exposed that, brought that up. And it was just a simple thing where a lot of times I take the ready, fire, aim approach, when the ready, aim, fire approach is often better. Sometimes I'm kind of a bull in a china shop. And so we got that off the table. It's like, yeah, geez, I did do that. That's part of my ready, fire, aim strategy, where sometimes I need to look at the other one. And then it ended up that this is probably going to triple my income and achieve my definite purpose income just with this opportunity. I recognized it. I have made immediate plans. And when I got there, he said, well, what were your plans this weekend that you were coming to Ottawa? I said, I had no plans. I was coming to see you. He's like, wow, thank you for, you know, taking time. Your wife came down, you drove down, spent a weekend here, when really your plans were just to see me. So recognize the opportunity, jump on it as soon as you can, at least examine it, and who knows where it can go, because those ones that told you shouldn't go and shouldn't talk to them, those are the people that miss those opportunities that probably are right in front of their face at times.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. Great point.
Now, one thing, Scott, it's not always on my list, but here's one thing. Napoleon Hill wrote fairly strongly in numerous places that the best mastermind group to have, when possible, is with your spouse. And the examples he used were often Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, which if people just knew of those two guys, they don't really know that it was their wives that really encouraged them, supported them. In Thomas Edison's case and Henry Ford's case, they worked with them. They did experiments together and discussed things. And so how important is it as an entrepreneur to have your wife as a mastermind partner? Because if they aren't, And entrepreneurs can have many and sometimes crazy and sometimes ridiculous ideas. And so how important has it been for you to, well, when your wife met you, you've always been an entrepreneur, but is it nice to be able to have a wife that's like, okay, this could be a crazy idea, but if anybody can do it, you can do it?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I three ways I'd answer that. The first is I was married once before, and in that relationship, the person I was married to came was raised in a family that wasn't an entrepreneurial type of family, and so the ups and downs that go with entrepreneurship weren't kind of the thing that she experienced every single day growing up. I think that was difficult. My wife Rachel, she grew up in a family of entrepreneurs, and so you know the ups and downs that go with entrepreneurship, you know the results, the risks and rewards of you know that happened. That was what she knew, and she felt comfortable in that. And so for me personally, I got really lucky that she had that background. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think it is so important before anyone starts any type of entrepreneurial venture to talk to their husband, wife, spouse, significant other, boyfriend, girlfriend. It doesn't matter, because being an entrepreneur really takes everything, right? It becomes all of your life. You know, your family, your finances, your paycheck, everything gets wrapped up in this business, and it becomes a 24-hour thing. And so if your partner isn't on the same page with you when you get started, when things get intense, as they always do in the business, because we all have our ups and downs, when things get tough, you're going to have challenges down the road. So it's really important to establish that up front, whether or not both sides are, you know, are ready to go down this road. I think another thing that's important is I think that the only job harder than being an entrepreneur is being the partner, like the spouse, the partner of an entrepreneur. Because, again, because of the ups and downs, the fact that most of those spouses or partners don't, you know, they may hear about the tough stuff. They don't necessarily know about the good stuff going on every day, because that's kind of what gets communicated. So it's a very difficult job to have, is to be that spouse or partner. It's really important to establish how much that partner wants to know or doesn't want to know day to day about what's going on in the business. And I found this from talking to so many entrepreneurs and their spouses. Some want to know everything. Some, they don't want to know everything because they can't. The anxiety of the ups and downs of a business is just too much. And so I think it's really important, again, to develop ground rules. First, you know, this is what I want to do. This is probably what it's going to take and what it's going to cost in terms of my time, my energy, my effort, how it may impact us. Got to get on the same page. That's number one. You know, number two is really understand how much or how little your partner is wants to know about, you know, and when they want to know it. So important. I think if you can establish these things up front, again, it really helps down the road when things get tough with the business. And so that it's one of the biggest pieces of advice that I try to give to entrepreneurs, particularly first-time entrepreneurs.
That is an amazing one. I'd never heard of how much do they want to know, because they may support you and encourage you and be behind you, but they may not want to talk about it 97% of the time. And you need the one who will be encouraging and supporting. I'm thinking of my very, very good friend Shane Moran, the co-founder of Organo Gold, and his first marriage broke up fairly quickly, and it was kind of a real shock to me at the time. But she was used to, as your first wife, she was used to someone who works at a job and gets paid every week or two. And Shane's always been an entrepreneur, and so immediate friction. But now his wife that he has now, Josie, amazing woman, as he said, an entrepreneur, takes a ton of your time. He's away a lot. He's in front of thousands of people. He's in front of thousands of women. And so you got to have trust. You got to have confidence. You got to be knowing that this is just who this person is. They're an entrepreneur. But at the same time, I know that Shane's wife doesn't want to talk 97% of the time about business. And when he's at home, he knows that. And he has a totally separate life from business when he's at home. And, boy, I had never thought of that. Establish up front, you know, how much do you want to know? Do you want me to bounce every idea I have off you and how I my day went and who I met and what they said? And or when we get back home, do you just want to talk about the things that we had in common before I became this nutty entrepreneur, our family and all the things we have in common and our kids and all those issues? Because if you don't establish that, a natural thing for an entrepreneur to do is, you know, tell everyone who looks at them sideways everything about their business and what they're doing. That can be pretty annoying and often self-centered as well.
Well, there's two more things to touch on this. The first thing is being an entrepreneur can be awful lonely at times, because as you experience challenges with your business, you know, there are a lot of things that you can't talk to the other people in your business about. For example, if you're raising money, right, or the business is financially stretched, that's probably not something you want to go and tell all of your employees, right?
Yeah.
Or if you're having issues with an employee in the company, sometimes there's no one internally that you can talk to about that, or a partner. And so what happens is your significant other ends up becoming your chief venting officer, right? And it's the only person that you know that you can vent to. I call it
the CBO.
The chief venting officer, and we need to really be mindful of that, and that's the first thing. The second thing, and I think this is a really important tip, is one of the biggest areas of strain around entrepreneurial types of relationships has to do with finances and personal finances, and what will happen is an entrepreneur will start a business and in their head or on their plan, they'll commit to maybe investing a certain amount of their own capital into the business. And what they do is they take that money out of their checking or their savings account. They typically do it on a monthly basis or as bills become due. And what happens with most businesses is they just take a little bit longer than we expect to take off, right, to get started, to really take off and to pay for themselves. And so typically, in those scenarios, what happens is more money than we anticipated up front comes out of that checking or savings account. And so it starts to create some financial strain in the relationship. What I found to be really helpful is with your spouse or your partner to agree on how much money is acceptable to risk on this particular business and to invest in this business. Agree on that up front. Open a separate account, put that amount of money up front into that account, or have that money, say, for example, you're working a job. Let's say you get paid by someone else while you're getting your idea off the ground. Do an automatic deposit with every paycheck into that separate account for the amount that you've agreed on, so it always sits over there. And you know that what you agreed to hold on to sits in a different place. And that step alone will eliminate so much friction in a relationship as the business grows and develops and runs into hiccups like they always do.
Wow.
And it helps the other partner to feel safe.
Wow, we've gotten into an area that not a lot of entrepreneurs talk about. Pretty cool. Let's try and finish this up in the next 5 minutes, because we booked 45 and you and I could talk for 45 days. So, give me in 2 minutes or 3 minutes, tell me about Greg Reed's Secret Knock events and why people should go, because I have it as a written goal. I'm going to one of them. I may even host one of them here in Toronto sometime next year.
Well, I can't say enough about it. You know, first of all, Greg is my mentor. He is one of my closest friends. He's my business partner. I talk to him five times a day, and I couldn't have more respect for him. His event, Secret Knock, is I've been going to these things for over 20 years, and I promoted some of the top people in the space. There is more community, and there is more sharing, and there is more honesty, and there's more connection that happens at this event than any other event I've ever been to in the industry. It is such a great group of people. And the thing is, we've all heard this, this the saying that goes, if you take the five people that you spend the most time with, you add up what each one of them makes. You divide it by five. The number that you come up with will be what you earn, right? It's all about the power of the people that we're with. What's great about Secret Knock is you have the opportunity to be exposed to people, everyone in this room, that will help to pull you up and help to take you to where you want to go in your life. And that's really the beauty behind Secret Knock.
And that's what we talked about earlier. Those people are the ones who love to help other people the most. So people, find the dates for Secret Knock and get your butt down there, because it will be a life-changing experience. Thank you so much for your time today, Scott. I imagine that Tony Robbins and employers all over the country are going to be receiving large boxes in the next little while. And so be creative with the large box you're sending. And thank you so much. We've covered some areas that we hadn't intended but are so crucial. And probably, as I said, we could talk for 45 days, never run out of great topics to talk about.
That's right. That's right. Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
I will see you soon. You'll probably be at the Toronto seminar I'm going to arrange next year on Think and Grow Rich. And, boy, this has been one of the most fun interviews I've ever done. Thanks so much, Scott. I really appreciate it.
All righty. Take care, Tom.
Take care.
Bye-bye.